a third episode of more 1950s boy, Teenagers. Youth Club was initially a weird experience. Our ex-11 plus teacher, who still taught at our junior school, invited back ex-pupils to a youth club in the old school on a Friday evening. Given that secondary schools in the city were run as a single-sex establishment at this time, it was a rare chance to meet the opposite sex. I guess we were 14 or 15-year-olds, but hadn't factored in how our ex-school friends, who were girls, usually smaller than us, had matured in some cases into young women, while we were still struggling as spotty, gangling youths. They showed a lot more interest in elder brothers and other 16 and 17-year-olds, some already mobilised, owning scooters, motorbikes or access to their parents' cars. It was a year or so before it was our turn to appear mature to younger girls. Still, the Friday nights with records, table tennis and hanging about in best new jeans and polo necks or new shirts enhanced our burgeoning social lives. The evening was often rounded off with a walk into Sketty for a portion of chips. Oh, the hedonism of it all. Despite being the 1960s, I don't recall any evening visits to coffee bars that were meant to typify that era for teenagers. Apart, that is, from a pop-up one that preceded the concept of pop-up venues and was run in Sketty by students during the spring rag week. I'm pretty sure we spent every night there that week, and subsequent weeks we spent lamenting its passing. As time went on and we became more mobile, initially by bus, then scooters, motorbikes and borrowed parents' cars, the surrounding area opened up with beach barbecues, Gower pubs and further afield. After our O-levels, a number of us hitchhiked to Exmouth in Devon at the invitation of one of our ex-youth club leaders who'd moved there and said we could sleep on the village hall floor in exchange for some cleaning and decorating, I believe. I can remember pairs of us standing with our thumbs out on the dual carriageway outside Swansea with small rucksacks and bedrolls and our youthful sense of adventure. There was some vague plan to meet up en route as we didn't think Exmouth would be reached in a single day. By some miracle, six of the total party of eight managed to rendezvous in Weston-super-Mare in the same seafront pump for an evening of darts and underage drinking. We passed what I would think was an uncomfortable night, sleeping on the wooden benches in a seaside shelter before being rudely awoken by a council cleaner who announced he would be hosing the benches down in the next 10 minutes. Well, at least he warned us. The world was opening up to us in our teenage years, with our mobility progressing from early teens push bikes to scooter and motorbike ownership at 16, before the passing of our driving tests led to the occasional use of parents' cars. Before I passed my driving test, I experienced a false entry into the world of motorised two wheels with the acquisition of a Vespa scooter. For the princely sum, I think, of £15, I acquired a 10-year-old metallic blue scooter. Although initially pleased with it, ownership was not a happy experience. The only mechanical transport that I've owned that was less reliable was a four-wheel ride-on mower many years later. I spent more time maintaining it than cutting grass with it. Other friends also had bikes and scooters of mixed reliability. The main problem with mine was a troublesome cable change for the gears, and I can remember a number of slow returns home with the gearbox stuck in first or second gear. We lived up a hill at the time, so the alternative of pushing it home was not an attractive one. Unlike a number of my friends, I don't remember any accidents on it. Maybe it wasn't mobile often enough for them to occur. I didn't take my motorbike test, so I was unable to graduate to larger engine motorbikes, which is probably just as well. If I'm going to experience rapid acceleration, I would prefer it to be on four wheels, wearing a seatbelt. Once I passed my driving test, I left the world of two wheels with no real reluctance. The favoured form of transport was walking. We walked miles in the 1960s. I'm not sure what time South Wales Transport ran their last bus of the evening, but it wasn't uncommon to take a bus to Mumbles or Langland Bay Hotel for a disco. They started in the 1960s, before walking the 5 miles home on a weekend night. It's no wonder we were fit and not overweight. I can't ever recall taking a taxi, but it must have been a relief to gain access to the occasional use of parents' cars. Unfortunately, this could bring a different set of hazards. Cars of that era were much less reliable, but also subject to the recklessness of youth. And having only recently graduated from various two-wheel forms of transport, let's just say we were not always the most careful drivers on the roads. I recall a couple of incidents in those years, but will preserve identities to save embarrassment. A couple of my school friends had taken and passed their driving test before I had, and this being the 1960s, the cars they drove, nominally owned by their mothers, were Minis, and when I did take a few driving lessons and entered my test, it was also in a Mini. Compared to the cars of today, and particularly the 21st century BMW Mini, they were cars of a different complexion. The first difference was their size. They looked tiny and low to the ground, with very small wheels pushed out to the four corners. Inside, they seemed implausibly to have more space than you would think from the outside. Some of this space was achieved by pushing the inside close to the outside, that is, neglecting any thick insulation panels on doors, boots and panels. The lowness and lack of sound deadening allowed a greater sensation of speed, amplified by the noise of the engine, that sounded as if it was in the passenger compartment with you. This was described as giving a sporting characteristic, an impression confirmed to owners by the success of the cars in rallying, including winning the famous Monte Carlo Rally. They would ignore the fact that the rally winner was a Mini Cooper S that had been tuned by a team of rally mechanics. This was an inconvenience. So in a world yet to be subjected to airbags, seatbelt laws and breathalysers, Minis were often driven as if they were in rallies. This was particularly true of my school friends in their mother's Minis. I remember returning in the following car from an outing to a country pub near Llandilo to spot a friend's car sitting on the lawn of a bungalow on a tight bend, facing towards the road, and the occupants clambering out to be harangued by the resident over the recently created gap in his hedge caused by the Mini losing control and spinning off the road. I think it was pushed back through the hedge and driven back home. Another potentially fatal incident occurred in the narrow country lanes of the picturesque Gower Peninsula. A group of us were returning from an overnight stay at a popular caravan park, and I was travelling in a friend's mother's Mini, following others in the friend's mother's Morris Minor. Rounding a tight country bend, we were shocked to see the Morris facing towards us, upside down, on its roof in the road. We screeched to a halt and climbed out of the car as the shocked occupants of the upside down car, gingerly and more awkwardly, did the same. Miraculously, no one was seriously injured, and the main drama, apart from moving the cars blocking the road, was trying to calm the driver, who was exclaiming, "My mum will kill me!" Once the car was righted and moved to the side of the road, we were able to assess the damage. This was limited to an intriguing dent in the rounded roof and an inability of both the front doors to close. A reluctant driver went to the nearby house to ask to use their phone to relay the bad news to his parents. His father arrived some half an hour later, who was also well known to us in earlier times as our affable scout troop leader. Today his affability was in short supply. In a businesslike manner, he checked the passengers for injuries or concussion, and then established which of the passengers from the undamaged car held a driving licence. It then fell to me to be the nominated driver of the misshapen Morris back to my friend's house, but only after the two non-functioning doors had been securely closed by ropes. The drive was cautious and a leisurely one, with me leading the small procession at a stately 20 miles an hour. On arrival at the house, my friend's mother was waiting in the drive and met me with an irate, "What have you done to my car?" before the true guilty party was exposed as her son, and I received an apology having been correctly identified as an innocent party in the incident. I believe the Morris has written off, but for a while, rounding corners in Gower Lanes gave me flashbacks to the likelihood of seeing a car on its roof.